welcome to the Indie Week program. I'm John Federson, and I weekly read to you this journal. And the recording date for this issue is February the 9th of 2023. It's available as a podcast, and our initial broadcast is on Friday in the afternoon. After that time, it's available for replay if you wish. It's provided as a service for our blind and print-impaired readers, and is from the North Carolina Reading Service, of course. And we begin with the Indie Week online, indieweek.com, which has more articles than appear in the print version. And this is about a public meeting at Raleigh City Council after Daryl Williams' death. Despite a packed agenda at the City Council meeting Tuesday, more than a dozen local activists, joined by run-of-the-mill Raleighites, put the spotlight squarely back where it belongs, on the tasering death of Daryl Williams at the hands of Raleigh police, writes Jasmine Gallup. Williams, 32, died on January 18th after being tased multiple times by police officers. At one point, the man was tased twice in less than a minute, with police placing their tasers directly on his body. Williams was heard on a body-worn camera saying, "I have heart problems," according to the five-day report released by Raleigh Police Department. He was sitting in a car in a parking lot in southeast Raleigh when he was approached by Raleigh police officers on a proactive patrol, according to the report. This policy has been compared to stop and frisk by activists who say it disproportionately targets blacks and harasses them for being in their own communities. One by one, a steady stream of people came to the podium Tuesday night to speak about the death, including Dawn Blagrove, Executive Director of Emancipate NC, Zainab Baylock, a former City Council candidate, and Annette Exum, Order of the Property, owner of the property where Williams was killed. She said, "I'm here because several nights ago someone called me and told me that somebody was killed on my property in Raleigh, North Carolina, killed, and he was in police custody. That was unconscionable." Collectively, the public commenters demanded the end of taser use and proactive patrolling by the RPD, firing of the officers involved in Williams' death, and a restructuring of the city's police advisory board, among other things. Blagrove, who spoke about an hour and a half into the meeting, demanded the city council ban the use of tasers until RPD can prove they will follow their own policies around the use of force. Quote, "Daryl Williams is dead because RPD failed to follow its own written policies for justification and use of non-deadly force." Blagrove alleged at least 16 policies were violated by officers that night. "Flagrant disregard of policies transforms non-lethal weapons into instruments of death." He went on to say, "RPD suffers from irresponsible and dangerous lack of oversight and accountability." She said, "An out-of-control police department with no accountability or functioning leadership creates a real and present danger to black and brown people in southeast Raleigh. You are elected to run the city in a way that's ethically and fiscally responsible. Allowing RPD to run roughshod over an entire community with impunity satisfies neither of the aforementioned responsibilities." Meanwhile, Jennifer McKinney of the Southern Coalition for Social Justice demanded the end of proactive patrols by RPD, calling it surveillance of black neighborhoods. and saying officers must stop approaching individuals without probable cause that a crime is being committed. Bailock, who ran for city council last year before dropping out just ahead of the November election, spoke passionately about the need for the officers involved in the death to be brought to justice. Quote, "These officers electrocuted Darrell Williams to death in the parking lot. Darrell was not a threat to the public, nor did he have any weapon on him. He was merely a black man existing in Southeast Raleigh. If any other department had an employee that violated a policy and it resulted in the death of a person, they would be fired immediately and charged with murder. The fact that these officers are suspended with pay shows we do not value human life." During the evening meeting, several people also brought up long-standing concerns about RPD's budget and the city's crisis response unit. Cole McMullen criticized the city council for continually increasing the RPD budget despite what he calls a legacy of wrongful arrests, deaths, and no-knock warrant raids. Yet another commenter re-raised the idea of revamping Raleigh's ACORN's unit, citing Durham's pilot programs, including one that embeds counselors in the 911 call center. Despite the variety of demands placed on the city council, one thing the public commenters agreed on was that policing itself is a racist system with roots in white supremacy. In asking for change, people said radical shifts were needed, if not an entire rebuilding of the system. And when it comes to RPD, the city council has the power. Earlier on Tuesday, during an afternoon meeting, Mayor Pro Tem Corey Branch also brought up Williams' death, questioning how the city council should move forward to ensure everyone returns home at night. Branch said, "Every life is important. As much as we want our officers to return home safe and sound, we want every resident in the city to return safely home. We want to make sure any encounter is an encounter where everyone can walk away." Body camera footage of the incident is set to be released Friday, said City Manager Marshall Adams David. Per procedure, the State Bureau of Investigation is also conducting a criminal investigation while RPD conducts its own administrative and internal affairs investigations. When asked if the City Police Advisory Board would consider revising policies around taser use, Adams David said, while they are not meeting specifically on the matter, quote, "I am certain that some of these policies will be lifted up as part of their review for the work plan this year." The answer is unlikely to satisfy activists who are already concerned about the RPD not following its written policies. The city's police advisory board has also been criticized for being effectively hamstrung by the city itself, which has not allowed them to conduct independent investigations or discipline officers. Jeremy Gilchrist, who also gave public comments Tuesday, pointed specifically to the advisory board, saying it has no teeth and must be disbanded and rebuilt with investigative and subpoena power. Gilchrist said, "Nothing has really changed since George Floyd in 2020. We've renamed things. We've made a lot of symbolic gestures. We've taken down a few statues. But in the end, so what? People are still getting killed. We still have modern Jim Crow out there going on right now." Also from this same city council meeting, Jasmine Gallup again reports that the Raleigh City Council approved the series of significant budget amendments, allocating more than $4 million to affordable housing, prevention of homelessness, and legal assistance for residents. On affordable housing, the City Council gave $1.5 million to housing nonprofit CASA, CASA, to help with the construction of Kings Ridge, a complex with 100 affordable apartments, 50 of which are reserved for permanent supportive housing. They approved a $1.8 million contract with a nonprofit, Rebuilding Together of the Triangle, to run the Raleigh Home Revitalization Program. The program provides zero-interest forgivable loans up to $30,000 to low-income, long-time homeowners for necessary repairs and maintenance. The goal of the program is to help at least 200 homeowners over 4 years in areas near major transit. Councilmember Mary Black asked if the program will help people in Southeast Raleigh, since it is targeted specifically towards homes in transit-adjacent areas. Raleigh Housing Programs Administrator Erica Brandt responded the city has two other citywide home repair programs, and this one was designed to be specifically targeted. But if city staff received many applicants from just outside the eligible areas, they will reconsider their requirements. And the council approved the lease of 7 acres of land off U.S. 401, south of the Beltline, to Opiden Investment Company for a 119-unit affordable rental development. This will include 1, 2, and 3-bedroom apartments with rents ranging from $400 to $1,400 per month. By purchasing and leasing the land, the city can ensure long-term affordability. Next, on homelessness. The City Council approved $262,000 contracts, one with Passage Home and one with Triangle Family Services, to offer short-term financial assistance such as rent payments, case management, and crisis housing search assistance to people experiencing homelessness. And the council also approved $50,000 in funding for the Wake Legal Support Center, which opened last month. The center, which until Tuesday was solely funded by the county and through various grants, offers free information to residents to help guide them through the court process, the court system. District Court Judge Ashley Parker Dunstan, co-founder of this center, said, "Each year, hundreds of Raleigh citizens must appear in front of me and navigate the system on their own, representing themselves. We also know this affects underprivileged and minority individuals more than anyone." In Wake County, 11% of residents live in poverty and can't afford to hire an attorney. Free representation offered by legal aid is also very thin on the ground, with only about one lawyer for every 10,000 eligible residents. The center currently offers access to legal forms and information packets, free clinics to teach people how to navigate courts, and Know Your Rights presentations. Later this year, the center plans to launch a website with resources, as well as offer free legal representation from lawyers doing pro bono work. Primarily, the center will help people address small claims issues, evictions, landlord-tenant disputes, domestic issues, divorce, custody, child support. With funding from Raleigh, the center will be able to hire additional staff, including Spanish-speaking staff, and stay open longer, said Jennifer Lechner, executive director of the North Carolina Equal Access to Justice Commission and another co-founder of the center. "We've only been open about 4 weeks, and it has been overwhelming demand," said Lechner. Other business. Also Tuesday, the City Council heard an update on the Oak City Biz Labs program, which provides grants to businesses that lost revenue due to the COVID pandemic. The program offers grants of up to $30,000 to small local business owners once they complete business stabilization training. In round one, the city gave $1.1 million to 51 small business owners. So applications for round two of funding are open February 27th through March the 12th. A webinar about the program and eligibility requirements takes place February 20th. In response to concerns from business owners, eligibility has been expanded to include those who previously received Raleigh relief funds in 2020. Also, they approved a $350,000 streetscape and safety study of the Five Points intersection, where there have been several high-profile traffic crashes in the last few years. And they approved construction of traffic calming devices like speed bumps and traffic circles for 15 neighborhood streets, including Dixie Trail and Quail Ridge Road. They also approved a list of 20 roads for future traffic calming projects, including Brookhaven Drive and East Martin Street. Now I move to the newspaper print version. That's me shuffling the papers to prove that it's real. And this is, and again by Jasmine Gallup, Analysis Paralysis. And it's about the Dix Edge Area Study. It's a development plan that has culminated in 3 years of work, and it's back in committee. The study, which started in 2020 and ended last year, involved consultants and city experts looking at the area around Dorothea Dix Park, which is facing rapid development, and proposing guidelines to shape the future construction of affordable housing, roads and greenways, among other things. As the city grows and Dix Park renovations begin, nearby residents have faced higher rents and more traffic in what was once an affordable place to live. The opportunity to build so close to downtown Raleigh has drawn interest from prominent development groups, including Kane Realty and Merge Capital, in some cases displacing residents who have lived there for years. Last spring, a dozen or so renters were forced to find a new place to live after a large development company bought their homes with plans to build two 20-story apartment buildings on the land. Today, three major construction projects are slated for the area around Dix Park. Downtown South, a mix of office, retail, and residential space on 140 acres, with some buildings up to 40 stories tall. Park City South, another mixed-use development up to 20 stories tall. And South Park, a commercial and office complex only a few stories tall. What's the plan? The Dix Edge Area Study proposes a set of amendments to Raleigh's comprehensive plan, a citywide map for growth that guides the council's decisions on rezoning cases and other important issues. The city council isn't bound by the guidelines in the comprehensive plan, nor is it bound by recommendations from the Planning Commission. But the proposed changes provide the council with a solid foundation for accepting or rejecting new development plans around Dix Park. Councilmember Jonathan Melton says it's a community-driven plan for growth in that area. There's a lot of changes happening in that part of the city, and we can either let those changes happen haphazardly, or we can have a roadmap for how they ought to happen. In addition to modifications to the city's land use map that scale up residential development, the proposal includes some environmental protections like directives for green stormwater management and measures to preserve and increase affordable housing, such as education about home rehabilitation, funding, and development of affordable housing on city-owned land. The proposal also includes plans to connect streets and greenways, add bike lanes and sidewalks, and add lanes and street trees to roads. Why is it stalled? But all of those changes are currently stalled with the plan back in committee. During the council's meeting last month, members voted 7-1 to send the plan back to the Growth and Natural Resources Committee, headed by District D Council Member Jane Harrison, for more discussion. Council members Harrison, Megan Patton, Mary Black, Christina Jones, and Stormy Forte all voted for the motion before Jonathan Melton and Corey Brantz joined them when it became clear they had a majority. Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin voted against sending the plan to committee, saying at the meeting she'd rather discuss the plan with all eight council members present rather than in the four-person committee, which, in addition to Harrison, includes Patton, Black, and Branch. The heart of the argument was over whether new council members who have greater influence in the Growth and Natural Resources Committee should have control over how and when the plan moves forward, or whether it should stay with the City Council as a whole for discussion and debate. Discussion in committee gives three of the four new council members an opportunity to take a deep dive into the plan, addressing their concerns about not having enough time to consider it before voting, Black pointed out. But Baldwin rebutted, "There's value in having re-elected council members at the meeting for perspective," she said. In a pointed comment about the new balance of power on the City Council, Baldwin told Black, "You've said a lot of times you just want to learn. Well, part of how you learn is through our joint experiences." Meanwhile, Melton's main objection to sending the plan back to the committee, or, as was also proposed, a work session, is the delay it would create. "We need to give everyone an opportunity to feel heard on this piece, and for the new council members also to absorb some of the work we're caught up on, but I don't want to push it 2 months. Each day we don't act on this, we're losing opportunities," said Melton. "If we need to have a discussion, we can have a discussion now or at the table in 2 weeks, but at some point we have to do something." In an interview with Indy, Melton adds that although he's sensitive to the experience of being a new council member, "We did get the plan at least several weeks ago." He said, "I was trying to find a way to strike a balance between letting new members have time to absorb it, addressing some of the tangible concerns we heard at the public hearing, but then advancing the majority of the plan that I know the community has been waiting on for several years." One of the biggest issues raised at the public hearing was over the reclassification of an area along Fayetteville Street, currently home to single-family houses, to an urban corridor which would allow greater density and buildings up to 8 stories, or 12 stories if they include public benefits. Christopher Busbin, who spoke on behalf of a nearby Kairale neighborhood, said, "Creating an urban corridor on Fayetteville Street is not only inconsistent with the 2030 Comprehensive Plan and future land use map, but it would be the most dramatic zoning change proposed in the entire Dick's Edge study." However, the place type change also fits with the city's plan to develop an affordable housing complex on the site. That's a city-initiated zoning change that's part of the council's larger effort to build more affordable housing. "To be real," wrote Harrison in an email, "it's complicated." The new council member wrote she wants to be thoughtful before trading in green space for more development, particularly in a forested area that protects the floodplain around Rocky Branch Creek, providing needed erosion control, water quality protection, and green space opportunities in what otherwise is a heat island just south of downtown. Harrison says she's also worried about building more in an area that is surrounded by low and middle-income neighborhoods, as well as one that is upstream for frequently flooded Rochester Heights, a historic African-American community. At the same time, she understands the need for affordable housing. She wrote, "At the Growth and Natural Resources Committee, we will review buildable areas on the site and consider the multiple paths to achieve more affordable housing in this area. This isn't the only one." Harrison's motion to move the issue to the committee also stems from a desire to add additional environmental and affordable housing protections to the comprehensive plan. Not all of the recommendations from the Dick's Edge study made it into the amendment proposal. Among the amendments Harrison wants are a provision to work with local developers to build affordable housing on infill parcels to incentivize affordable housing with city funding for infrastructure, and to provide land grants to nonprofits building affordable housing. Harrison said she also wants the city council to consider directing developers to conserve nearby wetland and river corridors, as well as study strategies to mitigate erosion along Rocky Branch Creek. So what happens next? Ultimately, the decision about whether to move the Dix Edge study to committee or discuss it among the entire council seems to come down to scheduling issues. Although many city council members favor discussing the item at a workshop, time-sensitive development issues and budget items have filled the workshop agenda for the next several months. Still, some are concerned this marks a new era of analysis paralysis for the city. Of the 8 rezoning cases that came before the council last month, only one was approved, noted Eric Brown, a former land use lawyer and local political commentator, in a newsletter for Raleigh Forward. That's a 501c4 organization that monitors city council's goings-on. All 8 rezonings were recommended for approval by the city's planning commission. Brown wrote, several zoning cases that could add to the city's housing supply, including permanent affordable housing, were deferred or placed into committee for additional study. While deferring cases or placing them in committee is not unusual, council must act reasonably swiftly on housing proposals due to the significant time it takes to permit, finance, and build them. Brown continued, every delay adds further time between when a project is approved and being occupied by new residents. Now, discussion of the Dix Edge Area Study will take place at the Growth and Natural Resources Committee's next meeting on February the 28th. After that, it could come back before the City Council in March. Next, from Chloe Nguyen, Dark Tower from Durham. While the days leading up to Christmas are often marked by celebration and warm memories for residents of J.J. Henderson Senior Apartments, December 23 and 4 were spent in the dark and cold without electricity. During a blackout at the affordable apartment community for seniors and disabled, their health equipment stopped working, they said, and no one checked on them for days. At a city council work session on January 19th, 3 residents of J.J. Henderson described a Christmas blackout of about 35 hours. They lamented that their apartments were dark, their electrical medical equipment stopped functioning, and the doors to the building were unlocked. The outage happened on December 23 and 4, but no one from the California Commercial Investment Companies or Durham Housing Authority came to check on them until the following Tuesday, December 27th. DHA, Durham Housing, renovated Henderson in partnership with other companies and subsequently turned over management to CCI. As senior citizens and disabled people residing in a recently renovated affordable housing project, the residents wanted answers. Rafiq Zaidi said, who's 78 years old and has been in that building for 17 years, we had no lights, no electricity, and it was cold up till December the 25th. We refuse to accept this. These people demand reasonable accommodations under the Disability Act. It hurts. It's degrading as a person that suffers with a mental health issue right along with a building of other people that suffer with the same disorders or more, added Pearlie Williams, a resident and former vice president of the resident council at Henderson. Anthony Scott, chief executive officer of the DHA, said at the meeting he planned to follow up with the residents at the 178-unit building. He hadn't heard of the outage previously, he said. In response to the residents' comments at the city council, council member Deidreana Freeman said she plans to investigate. I had heard this had happened, and I had asked the question just to try to figure out what was going on. I will be visiting over there at Henderson because it is concerning. Winter weather and a series of rolling blackouts by Duke Energy left 500,000 people without power on Christmas Eve, according to news reports. Those blackouts were widely publicized at the time, yet no staffers came to check on the residents of Henderson until the following Tuesday, said residents. In later interviews, residents clarified what happened during the blackout. Daniel Marshburn, another resident, said, "I felt someone was going to come and check and, you know, let us know what was going on. No one came around. It was Christmas weekend and they left on Friday and didn't come back till Tuesday. No one ever came up there and made sure we had food or made sure we had the things that people need." During the blackout, many of the residents could not use the equipment they relied on to help manage their disabilities. People with COPD, which is a pulmonary disease, were unable to have access to their equipment for oxygen and nebulizers. Zaidi said, really, they couldn't breathe. David McGee, another resident, said his electric heart monitor did not work during the outage. Williams said other residents could not use their electric wheelchairs. The doors to the building were also unlocked during the blackout. As a result, non-residents were able to enter the building. Cheryl Smith, a friend of the resident, said that the building relies on an electronic lock system, but during the outage, the lock system failed. Anybody from off the streets could come in, she said, and they did. Williams also said the building lacks security guards. When the doors to the building were open, she felt afraid. I was scared to death, she said. I was like, help me, what is going on? This outage occurred only 2 months after the complex reopened following $31 million renovations by DHA in partnership with CCI and other companies. Funding included a $3 million loan from the city of Durham. Changes to the building were made as part of DHA's downtown and neighborhood plan, which aims to increase affordable housing in Durham. DHA publicized the beginning of the renovation in 2021 and celebrated its finish with a ribbon-cutting ceremony in October 2022. Scott said, "We never took our eye off this ball. We knew we couldn't take our eye off the ball of trying to continue to redevelop our public housing communities because that's how you avoid a McDougald situation." That's a multifamily public housing community in Durham, which residents had to evacuate in 2020 after officials detected high levels of carbon monoxide in their apartments. J.J. Henderson, a nine-story building at 807 South Duke, has provided affordable housing for decades. With a renovation, new owners took over the building. A limited partnership called J.J. Henderson T.C. Senior Apartments L.P. The Housing Authority still owns the land, tax records show. After the renovation, DHA turned management of J.J. Henderson over to CCI. The Ninth Street Journal, which is the initial place this column appeared, reached out to Scott after the meeting on the complaints. In response, DHA Communications Manager Alaya Sanders issued an email statement on behalf of DHA confirming that an outage occurred at the building over the holiday. According to the statement, the building's emergency generator performed as designed. Quote, "The generator does not provide full power to the building, but provides power to the emergency lighting, elevators, and heating systems out of the apartments." Residents paint a different picture of their experience during the blackout. While the hallway lights worked, apartments were dark. Heat also failed in some apartments. DHA representatives did not respond to questions about the failure of the electronic lock systems or about residents' statement that their health equipment failed during the blackout. DHA also did not explain why no management came to check on residents until the Tuesday after. CCI representatives did not respond to multiple requests for comments. Smith said she tried to raise awareness of the blackout through a Facebook live stream 2 weeks after the incident. She said she came with residents to the council work session to ensure that the incident was public knowledge. That way, she said, if anything else was to happen, no one could say they didn't know anything about it. At the meeting, residents said they hope their appeals will lead to changes in the way their building is managed. We cannot have our black men and women sitting in the dark for almost 37 hours not having oxygen, said Zaidi. Williams echoed his sentiment. I'm appalled. I'm hurt. I'm angry. As a person with a mental health disorder and an advocate for the state of North Carolina, this should not have happened. Now, with Valentine's Day on the horizon, in fact, it's steaming up at us like an ocean liner, the sweet spot, writes Jasmine Gallup. How one Raleigh chocolate store readies its handmade small batch candies for the big day. The inventive chocolatiers at Eskazu are kicking into high gear, making as many truffles, bars, and specialty confections as they can. The North Raleigh Boutique Chocolate Store, that's a finalist in Indie Week's Best of contest at least 3 years running, is known for its handmade small batch chocolate, including rich ice cream and varieties of spiced hot chocolate traditional in Mexico, Spain, and other countries around the world. The store, which opened in 2008, is named after a region in Costa Rica, where some of the beans used by the shop are grown. The shop's busiest time of the year is, of course, the week before Valentine's Day, when customers flock to the door to buy sweets for their sweethearts. In 1 week, Eskazu says, sells three times the amount of chocolate they do during any other month, except December, says the owner, Danielle Centeno. We try to get ahead as much as we can. There's a lot of things we can stock up, but a lot of our confections are also fresh, and we don't use preservatives, and so it makes it a little bit harder. After the Christmas rush, Centeno and her business partner, Tiana Young, don't have much time to prepare for Valentine's Day. They've been making chocolate nonstop since January. It'll be very busy here starting this week, says Young. Valentine's is a procrastinator's holiday. Indy Week caught up with Young and Centeno in early February while they were still hard at work to talk about the business and art of making chocolate. Question and answer. Eskazu makes chocolate from scratch, starting with a cocoa bean. How does that work? First step in the process is to hand sort the beans. They come in big 120-pound bags. You go through them one by one, and we're looking for anything that isn't a good bean. It might be a flat bean, or a moldy bean, or a buggy bean, or even a rock, or a nut, or a bolt. Once we have the good beans, they get roasted. We have an antique ball roaster. It looks like a giant eyeball that turns over a little open flame. The beans roast for about 3 hours, give or take, depending on origin and temperature and humidity. Then they'll come out and cool. Then the beans go through a process called winnowing. We have a machine that'll crack those beans and drop them down through a series of sifters to separate out the papery shell of the bean, which we call a husk, from the meaty interior, which is the nib. The nibs will then go into our grinders with some percentage of sugar and maybe cocoa butter, depending on the type of chocolate we're making. It'll grind for 3 to 4 days. And at the end of that, we'll pour it out, and it'll be chocolate. We store them in big, untempered blocks, and they'll age for a little bit to help their flavors round out and kind of come together. Then it goes into ice cream or turns into confections or bars or hot chocolate. Centeno adds, once the beans come out of the grinder, the flavors are very bright. If you let it sit for a while, the flavors kind of come into harmony. What is involved in making chocolate confections? For the bars and confections, you temper and mold the chocolate. That tempering process aligns the sugar and fat crystals. They're so, so small. That's what gives you the shine and the snap, what we know as chocolate. On this side, you can see the million molds that we have right now. Anything you see in the shop that is shiny with color, that is colored cocoa butter. When the chocolate goes in with cocoa butter, it just wants to adhere to it because it belongs to chocolate. Young says, we hand paint the molds with a brush or an airbrush. Then you ladle the chocolate into a mold, shake out the air bubbles. You let it set just long enough so you have a shell. Then you dump the rest of the chocolate. These shells are going to be filled with ganache or caramel or whatever we use. What kind of chocolate do you make? The different kinds of chocolate mostly refer to the percentage. We make a 65% blend of beans from different origins. We pick those beans based on whether they'll pair well with everything. We use our blend to make all of our confections, ones with lavender or raspberry or alcohol. So it has to be delicious but not too loud about its own flavors. With a blend, it's also a little bit easier to have it taste the most consistent from batch to batch. But even if you have the exact same beans, it's still going to vary because every harvest always feels different. Question, how does the harvest affect the flavor of chocolate? People don't really see chocolate as an agricultural product that changes. Like strawberries, you might get them last summer and they were delicious. But this summer it rains too much or there's not enough sun, so they're not going to be sweet enough. The flavor of chocolate depends on the bean, because you can have beans that are a little bit more fruit-forward, maybe a little tobacco, maybe a little dried cherries. Then you can have others that are more fudgy and nutty. Mass chocolate producers, as Young, over-roast their beans and add a lot of additives to make it taste super-duper consistent. They don't care about the quality of the bean itself because they're going to make sure they standardize whatever they're getting to taste the same. We work with the fact it's an agricultural product. It changes and has beautiful and intricate flavors that you can preserve, just like wines can taste really different. Single origin chocolate can taste really different from one bean to the other. Finally, what is your day-to-day like? We try to keep production a little loose. We change it a lot. So one week, instead of your Pinella lime confection being dark green, it's going to be light green. A lot of customers come in and expect the same collection, or they're like, why can't my box have a guide? Because we change them literally all the time. Every single box that goes out is completely different. It keeps us creative and able to play around, as opposed to just being machines and producing the same thing all the time. Even if we're really busy, there's still a little bit of room to create. And Young adds, and to use your intuition, what do people enjoy? What do we enjoy? If we were just stuck in this box of making the same 20 flavors over and over again, then it would start getting boring. And all of those great ideas would go to waste. That's not what we're here for. We're here to taste things and bring you ideas and flavors and textures. And I have time for at least one more article. This is an op-ed, and it's written by Clayton Alfonso, who is an obstetrician and gynecologist at Duke Health. He writes, North Carolina House Bill 43, if passed, would make it illegal for any medical profession to provide gender-affirming medical or surgical care to any minor in the state of North Carolina. This bill also provides a civil penalty for providers who perform such care. This bill goes against the current medical standard for these patients, and I strongly oppose it. Research that has continually demonstrated that gender-affirming care of adolescents is vital and life-saving work. Suicide is the second leading cause of death in all young persons, and LGBTQ youth are 4 times more likely to attempt suicide compared to their peers. The Trevor Project's 2022 National Survey on LGBTQ Youth Mental Health showed that 45% of LGBTQ youth seriously considered attempting suicide in the past year, with nearly 1 in 5 transgender and non-binary youth having attempted it. The Trevor Project also showed that the rates of attempted suicide are significantly lower for the LGBTQ youth who are provided with gender-affirming spaces and health care. Statistics like this, which show improved outcomes of our youth, make me question why our North Carolina legislature would want to ban this life-saving care for my patients. The Trevor Project's 2022 survey also demonstrated that more than 75% of transgender and non-binary youth experience significant anxiety, and nearly 66% experience significant depression. In 2021, an article published in the Journal of Adolescent Health examined mental health among transgender and non-binary youth who received gender-affirming hormone therapy. This survey evaluated nearly 12,000 youth and showed that the use of gender-affirming hormone therapy was associated with lower odds of depression and anxiety compared with youth who wanted but could not obtain gender-affirming hormone therapy. Other similar surveys have affirmed these results as well. The World Health Organization in 2021 affirmed its stance on adolescent mental health, stating, quote, "The consequences of failing to address adolescent mental health conditions extend through to adulthood, impairing both physical and mental health and limiting opportunities to lead fulfilling lives as an adult." Again, I ask myself the question, why is our legislature trying to legislate against our adolescents? Every major medical association in the U.S., American Medical, American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, American Academy of Pediatrics, the Endocrine Society, and the American Psychiatric Association, among others, has repeatedly affirmed its statements that this care is medically necessary and has noted the harmful effects of not providing these services. Gender identity and expression are all a part of human development, and we should be supportive of our youth and expand their access to care, not limit it. It is imperative that these youth be given the ability to meet with healthcare professionals who can provide them with an evidence-based evaluation and care to best support them. This care is life-saving. North Carolina is not that far removed from House Bill 2. That's the bathroom bill that several years ago that was shown to have impacted revenue and business recruiting for the state, with cancellations in national conferences, major sporting events, and concerts, to name a few. Continued harmful bills like new HB 43 are also likely to have a significant negative economic impact on the state. As an OBGYN, I have seen firsthand the positive impact that gender-affirming care has on our youth. Laws like HB 43 have no place in our state, and I believe all medical decisions should be left up to healthcare professionals, patients, and their families. I would implore our legislature to put politics aside and leave the practice of medicine to professionals who devote their careers to providing life-saving care. And what are the odds of that? Well, Tomasi McDonald has written an essay, Brotherly Love, a tribute to a beloved coach and childhood mentor, this Valentine's Day. The world doesn't know a lot about Gregory Everett Sr., but he meant the world to me and a group of black boys coming of age in Rockingham, North Carolina during the late 1970s. If it weren't for integration, I'm pretty sure I would have been a starting guard for the Leek Street High School Tigers. Instead, my hoop dreams ended prematurely when Richmond senior high coach Roy Sonny Clayton cut me from the basketball team. This is a story about a different kind of love. It's a story, first and foremost, about brotherly love, also about community love and pride of place. Visiting my hometown now is heartbreaking. There are a few good-paying jobs in the manufacturing sector. Textile mills that made from a boom economy shuttered their doors decades ago. The most modest homes are dilapidated, and way too many of the once proud structures are uninhabitable. Far too many young people have guns and have resorted to drug dealing as a means of earning money. Once, we had sports teams. The textile mills that were responsible for thousands of well-paying jobs were also great civic neighbors. The mills' corporate bosses built baseball parks so the children of their workers could play on the little league teams they sponsored. The mills and other companies also sponsored the basketball and football teams with kids from all over Richmond County eagerly participating. After integrations, kids from all over the county attended the newly built Richmond Senior High, while formerly all-black schools like Leek Street became middle schools. Leek Street is now a community center. Looking back, it seems old Clayton cut the kids from the team who stayed closest to Leek Street School. My parents' front door is about 75 yards from the campus. My friends lived even closer. Clayton told us he really had no choice. He said we were being cut from the team because the school board had decided there had to be a certain number of white players on the team. We were pretty pissed off about the school board decision, but what could we do? Couldn't have been more than a week or so later, I was playing in a pickup game at the Leek Street gym and bawling my ass off. I remember that afternoon like it was yesterday. The gym was packed. I was wearing a pair of pink cut-off jean shorts and a white T-shirt. Barry Saunders, the writer, and my cousin, who I grew up with, was home from college. "You make the team?" he yelled at me from the sideline where he stood watching. "No," I replied. "What?" he answered in disbelief. That pissed me off all over again. I had to do something to express my frustration and youthful indignation. So I wrote a letter to the editor of our local newspaper, the Daily Journal, tearing the school board a new one for its own brand of reverse affirmative action. I wrote at the end of the letter, "I do not eat jump shots for breakfast, nor do I need behind-the-back dribbles to sustain me." The community response was considerable. Kids at school looked at me differently the day after the letter was printed in the paper. I heard from my former teammates on the team that Coach Clayton told them he didn't believe I wrote the letter. A school guidance counselor, Clifton Davis, pulled me into his office one day and suggested I go to college and major in journalism. The trajectory of my future plans shifted. Instead of appearing in the newspapers with my beaming parents, signing what used to be a grant in aid to play basketball at a small college, I began writing really bad poetry and entering speech and writing contests. But I still missed playing on the basketball team. Enter Greg Everett and his decision to form a youth basketball team with the guys in the neighborhood who were cut from the Richmond Raiders. I'm not sure why Greg decided to coach us, but his decision was significant. First, it increased the chances that a group of boys in the community with loads of potential would stay on the right track. Second, despite old Clayton's decision to cut us, we could still play organized basketball. And third, for me at least, it fulfilled my dream of wearing a Leek Street Tigers basketball uniform. Greg managed to get his hands on those old gold, blue, and white basketball uniforms worn by our uncles, fathers, brothers, and cousins during Jim Crow. We pull down those warm-up togs with the gold snap buttons that trailed along the sides of the trousers and those equally beautiful blue jackets with gold trim that featured a white flap in the back with the abbreviated word RHAM, and couldn't have been prouder. Playing for Greg, and with my closest childhood friends, was beyond rewarding. He was my first basketball coach since junior high who had confidence in my ability. Greg showed us how badly things could go for us if we chose the wrong path when he scheduled away games to the Cameron Morrison Reform School. It was a place where no kid who had the unfortunate fate of being sent there by a juvenile judge was ever reformed. We played our home games at Leek Street Gymnasium that was built by students enrolled in Mr. Johnson's bricklaying class, and truly, it was home. During the 1960s, wherever there were school events, light spilled out the gym's tall windows and it would glow at night like a glittering diamond. It was our Madison Square Garden. My father knew I was crazy about basketball, but had never seen me play. One night, he showed up at Leek Street Gym and leaned against the wall near the front door. That night, I scored over 20 points and had the game of my life. It was one of those few instances where I saw my publicly shy father smile. Greg later married my cousin Jeannie. This week, his daughter, Jennifer Michelle, told me the man never stopped coaching youth teams in the community. She sent me an old picture of him posing with a youth football team. Jennifer said her dad also coached a co-ed softball team that she played for in the 1980s. No one paid Greg a dime for serving as a mentor for a goodly number of young people. He did it for the love of the game and, most of all, for the love of the community. I just want to pause for the cause and tell him, thank you for being there, Greg, when we needed you. It was like divine intervention. Love every time, black man. Well, I confidently predict that the theme music will start up in just a moment. Oh, why, there it is. It's telling me to stop my reading of Indie Week and Indie Week Online. So I will, but just by telling you John Federson wishes you all a very wonderful weekend and reminding you this is a podcast available in the podcast section by simply going to ncreadingservice.org. And I will be back next week with another issue of Indie Week.